Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I am your NBN host, Lavinia Stan. We are talking today with Professor Ruti Tytel, the Ernest C. Stiefel Professor of Comparative Law at the New York Law School, co-director of the Center for International Law, and director of the Institute for Global Law, Justice, and Policy. Professor Tytel is also affiliated faculty with NIU International Relations. Hello.
Hi. Wonderful to be here, Lavinia.
Thank you for accepting our invitation. A graduate of Cornell University, Professor Tytel is an internationally recognized authority on international law, international human rights, and comparative constitutional law. But today, we are talking to her because of her outstanding work on transitional justice, applauded not only by legal academics and practitioners, but also by those addressing these issues in the fields of political science, public policy, sociology, and philosophy. Professor Tytel's monograph, published with Oxford University Press in year 2000, established transitional justice as a field of scholarly inquiry. Professor Tytel is the author of numerous articles and book chapters, as well as several other books. The most recent one, titled Globalizing Transitional Justice, Essays for the New Millennium, was published by Oxford University Press in 2014, whereas Humanities Law appeared in hardback in 2011 and in paperback in 2013. Her work has gained quite a following among scholars and practitioners alike and has inspired many to look into issues of transitional justice. Her book, Transitional Justice, was translated into Serbian and published in Belgrade in 2014, and also translated in Chinese and Spanish. But I also know that it has been cited by thousands of authors working on transitional justice on virtually all continents. Professor Tytel, thank you very much for accepting this interview. I have to ask, first of all, was your interest in reckoning with the atrocities of the recent past in any way informed by your personal experience in Argentina? Could you please tell us more about your journey from Argentina, the country of your birth, to the United States?
Thank you so much for this very generous introduction and opportunity to reflect on my book, both about my past and the book's legacy. In terms of Argentina, yes, I was born there and my parents were born there and from family that escaped to Argentina from Germany. So you could say that it was already predetermined that I would be interested in a number of justice scenarios and paths. Argentina was going through repression at that time. We were already in the States. I was studying in the States, but we would go back and forth because my father worked for the United Nations. And so we would go every year or 2 years for home leave. And it was already evident young people were being stopped in the street. There was a high police and security force presence. And so we stopped going during that time. And I was very interested. I already became interested in the period. And then as change occurred, there were meetings in New York that I attended. And at one of those meetings, I had just graduated law school. There was an editorial board member for the New York Times, David Unger, who had a personal interest in Argentina. And he reached out to me because as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he was interested in having someone write a backgrounder on Argentina and on, in particular, the debate that they were confronting in the immediate post-military period, which was the first democratically elected president was Raul Alfonsín, and he had campaigned on accountability, but it was very clear that there was military opposition to it, and so there was an issue both in Argentina, but also Uruguay and Chile, and so there was a backgrounder that needed to be prepared because the Council on Foreign Relations, as you know, a leading think tank both in the States and with an influence outside of the States, they wanted to have someone discuss and entertain what options there might be, and rule of law. On rule of law and on restoring rule of law in Latin America. And if you can imagine the hubris, because I was just out of law school, the question posed was, can the Southern Cone regain democracy without punishment? It was this debate between punishment and impunity. And so that is what got it going. And to add to the hubris, it was a 10-pager. And I was working as a young lawyer, and I never sweated as much over this 10-pager because of the concern that it would have foreign affairs impact and so forth. And in the writing of this 10-pager, which David gave this opportunity to me, because I knew Spanish, I could read the discussions that were happening in Argentina at the time, which were very interesting. I don't know if you know, but the cabinet, the first cabinet of the democratically elected president, Raul Alfonsín, whom I would come to meet, and I would come to meet the two cabinet members that were responsible for the accountability legislation. It included two legal philosophers. Imagine a cabinet with two legal philosophers, Carlos Nino, who's a remarkable person, died untimely, and Jaime Malamud. And they ended up drafting the legislation that would allow for prosecutions in Argentina. But anyway, this 10-pager, I realized in writing it that there was much more to say. And then what happened was history overtook the project. 89, 90s, early 90s, the changes in Eastern Europe, in Germany, former Soviet bloc, I realized that there would be comparative analysis and phenomena beyond Latin America. So the project took a dramatic leap at that point. And I applied for a grant from the United States Institute of Peace in 91, 92. And then I spent some time at that point, 92, 93, in Prague and Budapest, in Warsaw, to try to get a better sense for myself of what was happening. So it was really a remarkable period, I have to say. And nothing like that has happened for me since then. Of course, we have the Arab Spring and so on. But that was really a remarkable period that informed the progress of my book. And really the conceptualization of it, yeah.
So the 10-pager came at the beginning of the 1990s, and then with all the new democratizations in various regions of the world, you realized that the issues and problems you raised in relation to the to Latin America were pertinent for other regions of the world and for other countries.
Yes, but having said that, and I mentioned this in the very beginning in the preface of my book, the book doesn't say that there are less that it's a lesson and that everyone should follow what Argentina did. And believe me, there were people who were going around at that time of, you know, whether taking the experience from Argentina or from South Africa and seeking to export it to Hungary or Poland. It was really just to have that analysis and to and really I came away with the sense that societies do draw a line but on their past, need to do that, but where they draw the line and how they draw the line differs, and it depends on a variety of different dimensions. So that was really, you're right, that it was the early 90s was the first step of this book conceptualization, but then it would be the mid 90s, and really I ended up handing it in, I think, in 97, and it took Oxford more than 2 years to publish it. So that's how it comes out in 2000. Yeah.
But transitional justice, from what you say, it's a very personal issue. Yes. For you. To a certain extent, explains the passion that you have for these type of questions and the passion with which you wrote all your books and you approached all these subjects. Correct.
Thank you very much. I hope it's passion leavened by some sobriety, I would say. And I also have to say that I never imagined when I wrote that first 10-pager and not even imagined this with the book that it would continue to be of relevance today. And as you know, the subject matter has expanded to a field, and you yourself are involved in the production of an encyclopedia about transitional justice. So, you know, that's the next step, which we can talk about, which is the next step is when it becomes a field. And this I never imagined when I first wrote the book. I was a young scholar. I had a fascination, as you say, with these issues, but they're really human issues, aren't they? This question of how societies change, how they move from periods of repression to more, to liberalization, or at least somewhat openings, democratic openings. It's really something that's been with, in human society since the beginning. So one can't imagine having one answer or one size fits all, solution to the questions, but they do seem endlessly fascinating to me. Yeah.
Your book has been widely praised for its contribution to defining the field. The Review of Politics, for example, noted that your book is, and I'm citing here, an ambitious effort to look at law and justice in periods of radical political change, amounting to a provocative attempt to construct a general theory of transition and to identify the appropriate means for liberal states to respond to prior periods of injustice. In addition, Times Higher Education Supplement writes that Tytel's book is an ambitious and overarching attempt to understand issues that arise in and out of transitional justice. What are the premises of your book, and what is its argument, briefly, so that our readers understand?
So the book was interdisciplinary and comparative, and I would say an interpretive project. So it has normative elements, but the idea was really to interpret the phenomena that we were seeing at the time, really remarkable and with great alacrity, almost the entire continent of Latin America. Later, Central America would go through transition, but Latin America had been plunged in military rule, as you know, during that period. So there was change happening throughout, and as well as Eastern Bloc. And then we would see South Africa as well. So one of the features of my book is to see that this phenomena as related, that it wasn't authoritarianism in Latin in Latin America and totalitarianism over there. One of the features of the book is that I saw relationships between those, and clearly there were proxy battles between the U.S. and Soviets throughout Latin America and Central America. So that was already putting these in one book already, sends a message about the phenomena. But the other dimension really was to say that while there wasn't one lesson, that what we saw were that societies throughout the world that were going through political transition in that moment were having to draw a line on the past and to figure out ways to move from illiberal regimes to more liberal regimes. And that involved, in some cases, new constitutions, in other cases, amending them, sometimes trials. And we can talk more about Argentina's approach, but throughout most of Latin America, they eschewed punishment. The military were too strong still. So some of the important compromises that those countries dealt with, and the distinctive transitions in post-communist bloc that had gone through much longer periods of occupation and control from Moscow. And so, essentially the conclusions were that societies do need to draw a line, but that it was impacted by the nature of the repression, the nature of the legal traditions in those societies, as well as, and this is very important, I think, the extent or degree of commitment to change, so that the societies that really were nominally changing, but not really, with that continued to have deep state. And I would say Chile at that time, if you think about how long Pinochet remained, the general remained senator for life, et cetera. Institutions hardly changed. The military still had significant power, even during the political transition. Those elements, those factors weigh heavily in terms of what we saw in terms of transitional justice. So that is, I think, kind of very general, but a summary really of the conclusions of the first book.
So in the case of Argentina and other Latin American countries, how did justice work in those times of transition from military junta to democracy?
Yes, so important. The Global South generally is not as recognized in both law and politics. And so I'm delighted to talk about Argentina's experience. And there's a new film, so this is great timing to promote that film. Amazon actually is the platform. It's called Argentina 1985. And it brings to light, it's a docudrama about the chief prosecutor and the deputy. And the deputy would later become chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Luis Moreno Ocampo, and Julio Strassera was the chief prosecutor at the time. And it tells the story, very particular to Argentina, which is Argentina judged itself, okay? It's a successor regime that was able to manage to judge itself. And if we think about around the world for decades, even centuries, how rare that is, okay? Now, what preceded that trial was a truth commission. And we can talk more about that. But what we would later see in Latin America and in other places as well, South Africa is really the most famous truth and reconciliation commission, is that some countries that didn't push for punishment still felt the importance of public acknowledgement of contested facts that occurred conflict and about repression, persecution during the bad period. So Argentina really, kind of like Germany after World War II, ended up doing it all. They had both a truth commission, which preceded the trials, and the truth commission was headed by a world-renowned prize-winning author, Ernesto Sabato. And he had on the commission clerics, human rights activists, people of undoubted credibility and legitimacy. And that Truth Commission produced a report which documented the fact of tens of thousands of disappeared, including many children, unarmed civilians. And that fact is really the central fact that came to light in Argentina, that it really is the response to the phony claims by the military of that were used to justify a dirty war. And that justification was throughout Latin America. There was a shared quote unquote operation. And that is what the military used, Operación Condor. They used justification of widespread, the claim that there were widespread guerrilla throughout high schools, college. Yes, there were some, very narrow, could easily have been prosecuted and could have been managed by police the way we manage terrorism in democracies today. But a very important response by Argentina. And again, as I said, the trials tend to be neglected. The Truth Commission also often takes a backseat to South Africa. And so I think it's very important. I wrote about this in the chapter on historical justice in my book, and also about Argentina's trials in the chapter on criminal justice. But it really was fragile. It was a fragile moment in Argentina, which this film shows. It could have gone either way. It was important that the judges, the appellate judges, decided that to go forward. And even where there were jurists that were afraid to join the prosecutorial team, they turned to young lawyers that were motivated, as you say, passionate about the subject matter. And that's what happened in Argentina. And it would later be, I think now it's being cited in other legal contexts, but it was really, to my mind, Germany has its own trials and has had them for decades, but they followed Nuremberg. It was after Control Council 10 and the Occupy trials. Argentina really did something of extraordinary political maturity at that time. Yeah.
So Argentina, among Latin American countries, is the one that organizes this trial of the junta to reflect on the past, to assign blame for the past. What ultimately, what is the reason, or what are the reasons that make Argentina depart from the Latin American model? Because other countries were so keen on amnesties, on ignoring, let's say, the court trials for preferring other methods of reckoning with the past.
Well, I think that the political leadership, Alfonsín, ran on accountability, Raúl Alfonsín, the first democratically elected government. But it has to be said that while there was that burst of energy and that trial in 1985, the important trial of the junta, once there was a sense from the military that these would be open-ended, that the next trial and the next one could go to the next level and the deputy colonels and the lower level, they resisted. And so there was a period of time that Argentina had to stop the trials, and you had successor regimes that met with pardons, and then it starts up again decades later with a weaker military, a defunding of the military. So that's part of how Argentina dealt with its deep state. And so now, they're called human rights trials, and there was a lot of support from civil society and the populist parties, Peronist parties, for those trials. So I think it's a combination, I would say, of the political vision at the time and civil society in Argentina. And then, like the rest of Latin America, there is a period where it's all quite fragile and the future is uncertain.
So, Ruti, we talked about Latin America, we talked about South Africa, Central and Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union. How about North America? Is transitional justice relevant for this continent? And if yes, in what ways?
Well, thanks for asking that, because that actually leads to my current project. So definitely in the last 2 years, we saw remarkable events in the U.S. where ever since the civil rights period in the 60s, you hadn't seen the confrontation about white supremacy and black, you know, the absence of accountability of black anti-black repression, George Floyd, the remarkable number of shootings by police of unarmed black youth and demonstrations, right? The Black Lives Matter demonstrations, hit the streets. It was during the pandemic. So the killing of George Floyd was like a truth commission. It was something videotaped. It was slow-mo. And it was something undeniable. It was a shared truth that the society could not walk away from. And, you know, Biden made impassioned speeches during that time. I really think he came to his own as a political candidate against the other statements by Donald Trump, and that had really opened the door to expressions of racism and white supremacy, and ultimately would lead to the Confederate flag being paraded through the U.S. Congress in January 6, 2020. So we saw kind of a revivalist, you know, dimension to all of this, where it showed that that acknowledgement of what the Civil War meant and Reconstruction was very fragile in the United States and really had not happened. So long story short, there are proposals now in a variety of different contexts. Of course, during that period, there was the 1619 Project, a historical document to show the hundreds of years, that it was 400 years plus of history in the United States of slavery, that it wasn't just since the period of the Constitution or the early founding, but way preceded it. This is contested. There are a number of states where they have are trying to pass legislation or have public school regulation of libraries that can't, where the 1619 Project is a banned book, if you can believe it. So we really have an ongoing contestation even about the facts here. There was never a truth commission. There was never any kind of accountability of that sort in the U.S. And it wouldn't need to be called truth commission. That's kind of a Kafkaesque term. It's a more modern term, but really a commission of inquiry with a documentation. And now we have bills in Congress. Barbara Lee and Cory Booker have co-sponsored bills to have both acknowledgement and some form of reparations for African Americans in this country. It's highly controversial, particularly the reparatory part, because it's been so long. But I agree with you. I think that this is an issue, certainly the issue of accountability for slavery and then Jim Crow and segregation is not just historical. We can see the ongoing legacy, and this is really the problem, the ongoing legacy in the security services, in the treatment of Blacks in the voting, in terms of voting, in terms of banking, many areas which are now being explored. There are commissions in Congress that are seeking to you know, bring this to light. My own, I have a book project, which I could talk about later, which is kind of a wider theme about acknowledgement and about U.S. accountability throughout its history that is, you know, has a chapter on the post-Civil War period, but really goes back to the founding and to the role of the executive, the importance of having political vision. And I started the book during the Obama administration because I was very captivated by his speeches and by his attempt to single-handedly address some of the bad blood that had been caused, whether in the Middle East or in the Caribbean, other places, as a result of U.S. support for dirty wars. So, yeah, that's my current project.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And we are sure to follow it once it's published. But talking about North America, I wonder how you see the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada.
Well, I think...
Because the exercise of looking at the past here has been rather limited to one issue of colonialism.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I think that, and this is part of what happened with my second book, is we started seeing the globalization of transitional justice as a language for justice that preceded political transition or could come many years after. And so the claims for indigenous peoples in a number of places, Canada, Australia, claims regarding colonialism and much of the British Empire, also for restitution, this broader use of this language started happening right in the last decade or so, last 15 years. And so that's why I wrote the second book. And certainly I would say that the work that Canada has done in order to address these issues is an example of this broader vocabulary, this broader discourse of justice that transitional justice has been deployed to address. And I think it's very interesting, very different than when I first wrote my book, because it's not necessarily the justice associated with political transition, but it's a claim for justice that that is thought to relate to issues of political identity, and certainly for the Indigenous peoples, for First Nations, extremely important, right? And in the U.S., as you say, it's been more of a single issue. We're also seeing it, for example, against the church, right? The claims in Spain and in other places against, and you know, that happened in Canada as well, the unholy alliance of the church with in some places the state regarding indigenous peoples. And it's really these are remarkable and terrible stories once you get into the facts. We're seeing issues of disappeared children in Spain, in Franco Spain, that way precede what happened in terms of the disappearance and the kidnapping of children in Argentina. But the church is involved in Franco Spain, and we see a precedent that of how to deal with enemies, what they call enemies of the state, and that it's all about controlling the future, controlling the reproduction. And very once you get that, you can understand why this was so important as a strategy and so easy to do, you know, in terms of how well they could hide and cover up. So all what we have to do is be able to expose the cover up and in some way make reparations to those families. Very difficult. And that's ongoing still in Franco. I went to Franco, Spain. I went to Barcelona in May, and I met with the committee, the subcommittee on memory of the Barcelona Bar Association. And they say that Spain, it's easier to get justice for Argentina's disappeared in Spain than it is to address these issues and still have not been able to have these excavations of these lost, disappeared some of them children in Spain. And so it's a really troubling. And again, there was a recent film by Pedro Almodovar that sought to, if you will, illuminate this through film. And so we're seeing a turn to the arts as well here, where politics is static and frozen, a turn to alternative ways of. So that's a whole other area where we see transitional justice, the mark of it. Yeah.
Indeed. Ruti, you've been involved in this field of transitional justice for decades now. Do you see any developments over time in the way in which transitional justice has been conceptualized as a field?
Yes. As I mentioned a little bit before, a real change in terms of the central central dimensions at the beginning. I would say in the central dimensions at the beginning, it was the state. It was controlled by the state. So one way or another, if you had weak transitional justice, it reflected a deep state of repression and a lack of actors or institutions to in the state. So it was this state controlled, and you had a close connection to the political transition. Today, I would say we are way beyond the state, and we are beyond the political transition. And those two factors make for a very different transitional justice, which is really the third point. So beyond the state means sub-state actors, so civil society playing a much bigger role. We see that throughout the world. And we also see, as I mentioned, youth, artists, especially in the Middle East, very important. And then the whole idea of beyond the transition, anticipatory transitional justice, as well as long delayed transitional justice. So, in the Middle East, we had the 2011 Arab Spring, more or less around that period. And very exciting developments. It looks like backtracking in a number of countries, Egypt, even Tunisia, which was really the kind of the star. We have to remember that this happens in phases and it's not linear. And it was not linear in the United States either, or any of the countries that we think of as democracies today. And the U.S. now gets, lower marks on democracy, kind of a more fragile state, as January 6th reflected. But so the point is that we're seeing broader phenomena. So, for example, beyond the state, also not just sub-state, but transnational and multilateral. The UN, the International Criminal Courts, right? The ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, for Rwanda, and now the International Criminal Court. And what we see, now with the war in Ukraine, Russia, for example, is that we already see a language of cooperation between these institutions and the local actors. And that's a very different picture, a picture of much more, I would say, political sophistication and legal maturity that reflects that these international institutions have been around now for two decades. Very different. My book comes out in 2000. ICC gets going just the very beginning in 2002. So, I didn't have that in the book. And the conceptualization is that we are decentering the state as the main actor and also broadening the relevant temporalities, in terms of before transition and succeeding it. And that points to the phases of transition and that, as we know, and we can see worldwide, perhaps there are openings now with respect to Iran and China. This takes time, and it's not a kind of a one-liner in terms of one demonstration or trials or exposés. Yeah.
All of the people and the scholars and practitioners working in transitional justice are committed to it. But can you talk about the strengths as well as the weaknesses of transitional justice?
That's interesting. I think it's hard to talk about the strength or weakness of a concept, but I would say the following. I would say that its weakness, relates to its strength. So the strength is that it's a very capacious vocabulary, that people have found it useful across disciplines, because it isn't just about traditional understandings of law. It's not one view of politics, right? Realism or some kind of also utopian idealism. My interpretive approach in the book was really to look at the kind of relationship of law and politics in these periods and to show that periods of political change departed often from our traditional view of what would be rule of law. And so this discourse has been useful for in a variety of settings because it allows an imaginary that gets beyond the current moment in number of in terms of politics as it is, right? Or even law as it is. So that I would say is its attraction, its appeal. But it's also its weakness or its kind of the risks. The risks are the kind of 1,000 points of light, right? That, that one could point to having a truth commission and say, well, there's transitional justice in that country and that's the end of the matter. But we know that it matters who's running the truth commission. What phenomena is looked at? There can be truth commissions that are extremely narrow that don't allow a sustained study of the causes of the repression, and actually could be used as cover up or a way to distract from other more important factors or actors in a period of repression. So I would say that the risk is this idea of seeing it as just the modalities, right? That transition and that happened after my book. Unfortunately, there were practitioners that thought they were applying the concept and emphasized, I think, too much the toolbox. And the UN got going with this. And, the kind of idea that if you had almost a checklist, that if you went through the motions, that then you had justice. But, the part of the reason for my use of the term justice and not just law or not just historical commission or some narrow understanding of modalities, that you need more pieces in the toolbox in order to be able to evaluate and to have assessment of transitional justice. And that is happening today. There are a number of books and reports that are aiming to evaluate. It's very difficult, right? Because you're talking about many factors in a country and over extended periods of time, probably one of the most difficult dimensions of transitional justice are the books that have aimed to evaluate these experiments. But, again, that was the risk, was that people would associate some of these applications as equal or synonymous with the broader concept of transitional justice. So I'm still in the game to try to promote a more sensitive and understanding of the vocabulary, or at least the discourse that I think makes sense. Yeah.
If you were to update the book today, what would you add or what would you subtract from your argument? What was left out of the book initially? Did you include all your ideas, or there's something that was not reflected in the book? And how would you adapt the book to all these changes that you recognize put their mark on the field?
Well, I've been invited many times to update the book, which I do not want to do. I think the book stands on its own as the book that came out of that period, because it's really interpretive. And so it's interpreting the phenomena at that time. I would say that what the book doesn't have reflects the historicity of the book, which is it's published in 2000. So for example, since I submitted it, I would say 96, 97, there's very little about South Africa, for example, in the book, and nor other developments that might've happened at that time. There's less internationalism in the book because I don't have the examples of the ICC, nor very much about obviously the Balkans, etc. So that there are mentions, but that's why I published Globalizing Transitional Justice Thereafter, which was a monograph that in part has some prior essays, but sought to weave together the changes that we saw in the late 90s, which undoubtedly was a very exciting period as well for this globalizing dimension of the book. Again, if I were to rethink it, I think perhaps, one editing change, and again, I don't know how I would rewrite it, but it was such a Herculean task at the time. And I really think each chapter really could have been its own book. So that could have been maybe one way to deal with it. I had a box in the closet for each chapter, a literal box. But what I would say is that that writing it in terms of the different legal approaches or trans-legal approaches like constitutionalism and criminal justice and so on, perhaps led the reader to focus too much on modalities, and so that and seeing the book that way, I don't know how I would change it to, but I would perhaps have more of a cautionary dimension to reducing those concepts to the actual, to this view of modalities, that what was at issue is kind of an election of tools. Somehow that came out in practitioner work. I don't know if how much my book contributed to that or other political needs, at the level of the United Nations and changes that were occurring at the time. And remember that we are in a time of metrics and big data. So part of what we see is that the kind of transitional justice that gets done is what it can be measured. Trials can be measured, for example. Reports can be measured. So this is also not something that I could control, but it's something that upon reflection is something to think about, right? The book was pre-algorithms.
That's a good phrase, yeah. Thinking about the future, it just occurred to me to ask you, how do you see transitional justice applied after the war in Ukraine? What are the best methods, or what are, because we talked about the toolkit of transitional justice, but what was the conception of justice there? Do you see that this is the opportunity of the International Criminal Court to take action, or I've seen a lot of other proposals for other courts and tribunals being established. What is your view on transitional justice related to the war in Ukraine?
Well, we're certainly seeing the language of justice being deployed to delegitimate, fairly clearly Russia's aggression in this war. And we saw that, we can certainly see that it's a war of conquest and even under the traditional law of war, this would be considered to be a huge violation, aggression, right? And the International Criminal Court recently had adopted language that allowed prosecution of aggression. However, neither party is a member of the court. Ukraine opened a case, because of the rules at the ICC, aggression can't be a part of the ICC prosecutions. They can prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity, which they're already talking about with Ukraine. Ukraine has its own procurator general, and documentation is happening locally as well by the state, as well as NGOs that are on the ground there. The very difficult thing, and I'll come back to the importance of the aggression charge in a second, but the very important thing in a wartime situation is conserving the evidence. That's really the hardest part. And so we see that both international NGOs, Amnesty, has been in the region several times. The head of emergencies there, Joanne Mariner, Donatella Rivera, they've gotten a lot of documentation of what's going on there, as well as I said, the Ukrainians on the ground. And it very troubling, very, very distressing to see the evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity in places where the Russians have withdrawn. So this evidence needs to be preserved for any judgment, for any jurisdiction. Having said that, what's very interesting is that you, and also you have the International Court of Justice involved on a genocide case that Ukraine has filed against Russia. So you really have a number of international and domestic institutions, as well as NGOs, that are very committed to the case. And the U.S. Ambassador for Global Justice, Beth Von Schack, is also cooperating and kind of a multiplier effect to, as she puts it, to capacitate the actors on the ground with assistance of a legal sort. Having said that, you know, I think there will be issues, you know, going forward about what's the priority? And the good thing is that the ICC prosecutor has said that he's committed to cooperation, because in many ways there's a multiplicity of actors here. And that's a new theme, I would say, going forward, that, you know, it's in the past, it seemed very dichotomous that either the court took jurisdiction, applying a principle of complementarity, where they would decide whether the local actors were willing and able. And if they were not, then the court would weigh in. Here, he's talking about cooperation. And so I think perhaps it's kind of a new day that this war is ushering in a new day. And also, he's a new prosecutor. So he has a different approach than the prior prosecutors, whether Luis Moreno Ocampo, who really had to establish the court in the beginning, and his deputy, and then the successor prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. But for aggression, which is the main crime here, there's been a call for a new institution, because that would involve judging Putin and his henchmen, you know, the surrounding leaders that have weighed in with him. It's a close-knit group that made this decision. And but of course, if we were able to do that, the war would be kind of over. I mean, it would, you know, to be able to do this, there's been a call for it. Philippe Sands and also others in the UK have been very active on this. And I understand that the EU has finally joined that call for such a tribunal. I think there's a sense that Putin, you know, is so far gone that whatever caution other countries had about this, call for judgment now seems to have fallen by the wayside. So we'll see. We'll see what the future brings. You know, my own concern is that we restore. And, you know, I think this is a good note to, you know, end on, at least in terms of the Ukraine-Russia, is that when I identified the term transitional justice, it wasn't just about backward-looking, retrospective justice about, let's say, punishing those who committed war crimes or restituting land or some form of reparations, all of which are on the table right now for Ukraine. And there's a call to use, for example, sanctions against oligarchs for reparations. So there's a lot of innovative thinking. But what I'm not hearing is the forward-looking part, which is what transitional justice could be associated with peace, with conflict resolution. And this is a new dimension for transitional justice that we've seen in the last decade, which is the importance of thinking about the peace and thinking about justice as a dimension of that. And so kind of a just peace, if you will. And this is where I would like to see more thinking going forward. At least I'm trying to think about it. These are not easy questions. It's kind of a very ambitious project. And, you know, Ukraine so far has found it difficult to even think about peace negotiations, thinking that this would freeze the current political moment. But, you know, we have to somehow think about the future and how this war is going to end.
Thank you very much. One last question. What are your future plans in the field of transitional justice? You talked about a book project you are working on, but I wonder whether you can elaborate on this.
Yes, yes. So in terms of my book, I have it's called Righting Our Global Wrongs. It should be forthcoming in 2023. And it's a look at the role of the U.S. executive in across U.S. history. It started with Obama's world tour in the last year of his last term. And then I went historical from there to see whether he was the only one or whether there were other kind of more visionary American executives. So that is the book. There are a number of other projects that I've been involved in with other scholars. I have a piece coming out together with Dr. Yavor Rangelov, who is with the LSC. And he and I have written a piece on called The Justice Archive, which is about the rise of digital archives and transitional justice. And it's very interesting because given the passage of time since the trials that we've been talking about, whether in Latin America or elsewhere, since the Truth Commissions, there's a question of how to preserve those reports and what the next stage is really for the future. Because again, this question of for the future. So there we try to conceptualize a role for the Justice Archive, and we look at two regions, the Balkans and Latin America. So that will be coming out very shortly in the next issue of the London Review of International Law. So I'm looking forward to that. So we will continue to be doing work on the Justice Archive in former Yugoslavia. And the other work that I've been doing is a project of kind of intellectual genealogy, which is together with an author in Latin America, co-author Valeria Vey Weiss, on the role of Latin America in transitional justice, and that is to retrieve and restore Latin America to the global history of transitional justice. And because of language barriers, very often, even in even when we talk about America, what is international law, it tends to be American dominated. There's European international law and there's American international law, but Latin America does not get included in American international law. Similarly, Latin America, even though they were among the pioneers in this area, are not there. And so this is part of an intellectual project of restoring Latin America to the genealogy globally of transitional justice. So those are two projects. I'm also very interested in the Middle East, very troubling developments in Israel-Palestine. I go there every summer and I run a colloquium that is sponsored by Friedgal on transitional justice in Israel-Palestine. I'm also interested in Cuba, and I'm hopeful for change there in the U.S. approach. So a lot on the table. And Korea, of course, unified Korea is coming. And I have a book that I co-edited on transitional justice in unified Korea. So there's never a dull moment, I would say. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. These are very ambitious projects. Well, Professor Tytel, thank you very much for this interview and all the insights you've provided. I want to remind our listeners that our guest today at the New Books Network was Professor Ruti Tytel from New York Law School, who graciously agreed to talk to us about her 2000 book, Transitional Justice, an Oxford University Press publication. Thank you, and hope we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.
Thank you.